The Broken Clock Podcast is back, and as promised, we're going to be discussing deductive and inductive reasoning. And as I learned this past week, after we decided to talk about this, deductive reasoning can get you in a lot of trouble on the internet because people don't understand it. A big problem with the concepts of deductive and inductive reasoning is because the greatest deductive reasoner in fiction is widely known to be Sherlock Holmes. Unfortunately, Sherlock Holmes tends to use inductive reasoning more than deductive reasoning, and so people can't tell the difference between the two things. Now, Mouse is with me as usual, and he was the first one during the whole internet freakout of this past week to basically go, "She's doing Socrates," and I'm like, "Yes, I'm doing Socrates." Well, that sounds wrong, but it was stunning. It was stunning to me, Mouse, how many people no longer recognize basic deductive reasoning, meaning you set up your broad principles, you take those broad principles, you distill them down into the specifics of whatever you're examining at the time, and you get a result. So theorize, hypothesize, test, result. It seems so simple. More and more people seem to think that's evil. Do you have any theories as to why?
Well, first of all, it's because one of the things is that it doesn't match the pattern of what people think is deductive reasoning. Because, unfortunately, Sherlock Holmes, while being a brilliant detective, was kind of crap at marketing.
Yeah.
And the reason I say that is that Sherlock Holmes never deduced anything in his life. He was, by all means, an inductive mm-hmm. reasoning. So to be able to tell the difference between the two of them, induction works from the premise of you observe, you identify a pattern, mm-hmm. then you put up a tentative hypothesis, and then that hypothesis, when confirmed, becomes a theory.
Yeah.
Whereas deduction is kind of the musical episode from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I have a theory. It is a demon, a dancing demon. Wait, something isn't right here. You start with the theory. You move to the hypothesis. Mm. Then you go into the observation phase to see if the theory and if the hypothesis matches your expected results. And then you have confirmation.
Right. The example given in most critical thinking courses that I've been a part of is the idea that you see a white swan, and then you see another white swan, and then you see a whole bunch of white swans. And so you can induce that all swans are white. Now, of course, this is not true. Black swans exist. And that's that's the issue with inductive reasoning. Now, the thing about the Sherlock Holmes stories that they did away with in the TV, I'm blanking on whether they did this in film too, but certainly the TV kind of murder of the week format that they did with Sherlock Holmes for so many years was that they did away with his testing of his hypothesis. And in the books, that's what made him distinct from his brother, Mycroft. Mycroft would sit there in the gentleman's club and not test anything. He'd just go, "Oh, well, clearly based on the evidence, it is this, go away now." Whereas Sherlock actually went and tested his theories, which I guess you could claim is a form of deduction. Only the deductions in those stories involved in a lot of, you know, gun battles and running around London and falling off of waterfalls, right?
So yes.
There was,
as you do.
Yeah. who doesn't fall off a good waterfall a few times in one's life, right?
I mean, if you haven't, you haven't lived.
Exactly. But so you can't, some people overgeneralize to say Sherlock Holmes never used deductive reasoning. That's not so. It just wasn't the basis of what made him cool, right? And it's almost as if in this day and age, people think being a true intellectual is being Mycroft Holmes instead of Sherlock Holmes, which is, I think, a product of the adaptations that go on, that, you know, those moments where Watson goes, that's amazing, you know, which is why I love the Johnny Lee Miller, Lucy Liu version of it, because they turned the that's amazing on its ear into sarcasm. So basically in that show, they have Sherlock Holmes taking a lot of unnecessary cognitive challenges where he, you know, derives this massive theory instead of just going to check something out. And so Watson, he'll do all these things and all these, you know, outlandish Renaissance man kind of things. And she'll just go, that's amazing. And then it wasn't amazing at all. It was just a whole bunch of extra work. And I, unfortunately, that is a show that some people didn't give a chance because they were so on Team Benedict Cumberbatch and the BBC Sherlock Holmes. And that show, as cool as, I'm so torn on this show. And I know this is an aside, but I do think this is an example of how really slick artistry short circuits the intellect.
Oh, right? Gosh, that show to me was pure presentation and very little of the meat of Sherlock Holmes. In a way, it dumbed down Sherlock Holmes and tried to patch the hole of what was missing with kind of silly special effects.
Yeah, the idea that the classic Sherlock Holmes would ever poison a pregnant woman for any reason is just, it's such a violation of character. But the BBC Sherlock Holmes is no longer Sherlock Holmes, because instead of making him a very empathic character with bouts of depression and possibly some anxiety, they make him a high-functioning sociopath, which wasn't Sherlock Holmes. I don't know why they did that. I do know why they did that. It's that, what's his name? The guy who also did Doctor Who. He loves to give his character diagnoses that then he goes, oh no, they're not that. They're just funny, wink.
Moffat,
yeah. I mean, you know, they made, you know, there was that whole discussion about whether Matt Smith was on the autism spectrum and all those things. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh Lord, I get that that's his process, but it can go too far. And I mean, it's funny because there's this whole other type of reasoning or analysis that some accept as a separate thing, some claim is just a subset of inductive reasoning, which is abductive reasoning. Mm-hmm. And whether, you know, no matter what school you come down on, because it is something of a semantic, whether abductive reasoning, which is basically an educated guess, is different than inductive reasoning. But I found this lovely chart online that talks about when the different types of reasoning fail and why they fail. And this is what I'd like to focus on right now, because of the conspiracy theories running rampant on the internet, but also the, I don't know what to call it. I've been trying to think of a name for this particular sort of quote unquote activism that's just bullying with good PR. But they all, you know, all these conspiracy theories and all of these, you know, keyboard warrior activism types, they all take perfectly good processes and ruin them, right? And this one website, it's called complexwhales.com. I'm not sure what it is. It just looks like somebody's personal blog, but they make this lovely little chart about what happens with abductive, inductive, and deductive analysis involving, like, when you up the consensus and then when you up the coherence. Now, they use words that are a little too fancy for this podcast, so I'm going to downgrade peripheral cognoscenti, which is their first category, to relevant expertise. We'll say that. And so an expert opinion in terms of an abductive outcome, an abductive leap, is the way a doctor, based on a series of symptoms, comes up with the diagnosis and then prescribes. It's incomplete information. You can't quite be 100% sure a lot of the time. It's the is it COVID or is it the flu? Well, if we can't test to find out, what do? It's that kind of thing. That's a guess. Now, as those leaps in logic, those guesses become more mainstream because become more commonplace, then we get dogma. And this is obviously where things start to go wrong from a critical thinking perspective, because instead of it being an educated guess, it's just sort of a common, you know, these are the rules, obey the rules at your own peril, right?
Right.
If it becomes too widespread to the point that nobody ever questions the abductive leap, then we have groupthink. And that's where we get these conspiracy theories and these very strange activist statements that are just, you know, they don't pass the sniff test from a deductive perspective at all. But I'll tell you, Mouse, the people believe them wholeheartedly. And it's alarming to me that they don't test their theories, because testing theories, interestingly enough, based on this chart, if you're in that abductive groupthink myth category and you encounter someone who is an expert in the field you're discussing and they are using deductive analysis, that comes across as heresy.
Mm-hmm.
Which it describes so perfectly what happened to me online this week.
Yes.
I was using reason when they just wanted to perpetuate a myth, or if I'm being kind, perpetuate dogma, though I claim that this is what they were claiming was a straight out myth, to the point that I'm not even sure I want to repeat it. But yeah. So they saw me as a heretic. I saw them as, you know, philosophical, too philosophically dogmatic, and so stuff exploded, right? Of course,
that's a way of putting it. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's why deductive reason, analytical, systemized thinkers like myself, we need to be very careful to sort of come in at 50 to 75%, because if we step into that sort of cultural orthodoxy, the more commonplace way of thinking, then you hit standards, right?
Yeah.
And that's the thing about activism that I have found. I can only speak for, I've been most involved in gay rights activism, but I saw this happen. It happens with all civil rights movements. You start as heretics, right? I know I did. I'm like, what does it matter? People love, people need companionship. Gay people are people. Therefore, gay people deserve companionship. Very common Socratic deductive reasoning. That was the core of my support for marriage equality. It was no more complex than that, right? But my God, in 1994, 1995, when I get started in that, this was heresy. It was. People don't realize the bad old days were not that far away.
No, they were not.
And all that happened, it wasn't that my opinion changed. It just became more into line with
the mainstream.
The mainstream, common beliefs, the Overton window, for lack of a better term, right? The Overton window on this, you know, what the acceptable spectrum of opinions moved more into my purely logical heresy. It was no longer heresy. Now, where gay rights is moving is more and more the idea that marriage equality is important is becoming so commonplace that it's becoming true, right? And that's how logically argued, properly, proper logical deductions with good PR becomes move from heresy to standard to truth.
Yes. Right?
That's the way effective social justice happens, but it starts with a solid deductive analysis. Unfortunately, that's not the way most people think, right?
No, that is not the way they have been accustomed to think.
Right. I mean, I've just sort of presented the really, really extreme abductive reasoners that end up in that, you know, 16% of the political spectrum that's completely cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, right? And then right. You and I, who tend to get in a lot of trouble and don't care very much, but we gotta watch government representatives bearing hemlock when people
yes.
You and I do, right? I mean, that
right.
difficulty, and you see it all through history with guys like Alan Turing or even Albert Einstein to an extent, but he was better at making his ideas have popular appeal. But then guys like Oscar Wilde was brilliant, but he was so sure of himself, he didn't quite know when to shut up.
Yes, poor Oscar.
Well, and his downfall was actually him violating his own principles in terms of, you know, what's permissible, what's moral, et cetera, et cetera. But that's a topic for another day. Most mm-hmm. people end up in an inductive kind of mushy middle between the two extremes. And so what happens is they end up with a model of thinking, what some people call framing, which is a combination of sort of emotional beliefs with a smattering of examples that they draw from to go, well, this is real, right? Mm-hmm. You notice I said examples and real, not fact, because we're in the realm of all I've seen is white swans. Therefore, all there is are white swamps. What's the word I'm looking for? It's not a syllogism. It's not a syllogism, it's a slop. the ellipse, the solipsistic thinking?
Solipsistic thinking?
Solipsistic thinking, that's the word. It got stuck. I don't know why. So, you know, it's the only thing that exists is me. The only thing that exists is what I personally perceive and what I personally do. Nothing else is true. The problem is that most people exist in a realm of heuristics, which is mm-hmm. the wonderful realm of common sense is neither common nor sense. It's a series of shorthands. And there's reasons we engage in heuristics. They're quick. We can't spend all our waking hours deeply contemplating every picayune choice we make on a daily basis, right?
Right. We use their shorthand for our ability to make quick decisions and bypass any slowdowns, because then if we were to spend hours debating on whether we should have the pizza or the salad, it would be a painfully, terribly slow day. And we would probably way back when get eaten by a tiger.
Right. Well, and also simple things like which coffee chain are you going to give your business to? The truth is that the trappings around the edges in terms of, oh, what's more conscious or what's better for the environment? It's marginally different. If you're going to a chain, they all function in essentially the same way, one way or another. So this idea of, oh, am I going to agonize up here? It's Starbucks, Second Cup, or Tim Hortons. Because for whatever reason, Canada loves 3 to 4 choices. We are not a binary society like America is, right? Like Americans, I don't know why this is, maybe you can tell me. They're like McDonald's or Burger King. They forget about Wendy's, right? I don't know why Americans do this, but with us, it's like, oh, we want a burger. Well, we could go McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, Harvey's, Hero Burger. It's just like, it goes on and on and on. For whatever reason, Canadians, we seem to be much better with multiple choice, whereas Americans like binary choices. And I wonder if that's just because Americans, because of the way your system is structured down there, you need those heuristics or everything just becomes way too, what do I do?
Well, if you look at the history of America, the narrative that has always been very, very favored by the population has favored a duality, from its inception as a rebel,
right,
colony, so to speak, all the way down to splitting into two major positions in the Civil War. And then it's kind of a thing that's been perpetuated in it's a very dualistic, they're almost Zoroastrian if you think about it.
Yeah, well, it's all us versus them. There's no other guy.
Of course, you could also maybe allude to the fact that you had a very prominent Protestant, Puritan background.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, very, very staunch Christianity has a tendency to favor dualistic,
dualistic certainty, I guess, is mm-hmm. what the revival movement tends to.
Yes.
Interestingly, though, I mean, things like suffrage got going with the Quakers.
I know.
So every so often they can produce a good result. Though that was an interesting one, why Quaker men were more tolerant of women's suffrage than the standard Protestant guys, that they saw secular government as illegitimate no matter what. So they didn't vote. So they thought it was just kind of goofy that women mm-hmm. would want to.
Yeah.
There's an interesting framing, right? Like there's an example of a standard and then a heresy. They're closer together than a standard and dogma. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that, I mean,
it's interesting.
People assume that Quakers are quite dogmatic, and some are. However, it's undeniable that a lot of the American civil rights movement has been sparked and crushed in equal measure by its religious structures.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's an interesting point of history that undermines the idea that everything is an A-B choice, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is why being able to take certain inductive, you're not supposed to say educated guess because that's an abductive leap, but creating a working hypothesis through induction that you then test by deduction, it's an important skill to have. I think what's happening now, not just in the US and everywhere, I mean, you're seeing it in Germany, you're seeing it in England, oh good Lord, the France and Turkey thing right now. You're seeing it up here to an extent as well with the political jockeying that's going around in places, but inductive reasoning with too much consensus, meaning you don't challenge the thinking ever, with a moderate amount of coherence, lands in stereotype. And heuristics can very, very easily creep into the realm of stereotype. And that's the problem I think we find ourselves in, because people distrust deductive analysis, because done too purely, it can seem heretical.
Mm-hmm.
We've got this sort of decrease in the centrality of religion and therefore dogma and myth. Culture lands solidly in heuristics and stereotypes. And even people like Chris Hayes, you know how I feel about Chris Hayes.
Yes.
Here's my problem with Chris Hayes in a nutshell. He drops the word heuristic all the time because he thinks it makes it sound smart instead of just saying shorthand, but he engages in them all the time.
He does.
I mean, I went on his Twitter feed this week and it's brainworms. He's such a smart guy, but boy got the brainworms, my God. You know, whereas Chuck Todd loves to just be a little shit, like quasi. He likes to be heretical just on the edge of heuristic standard.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to punch him for that, because I'm like, you're doing this deliberately because you confuse contrarianism and intellectualism. But the people who, if you Google great critical thinkers, it's a list of contrarians. it's not a true list of great critical thinkers. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I know exactly what you mean.
It's guys like Christopher Hitchens, who was a contrarian. Hitchens was very smart. Hitchens was capable of critical thinking, but he often invoked emotion to get his point across and shut people up quickly, which is a heuristic.
Yeah. And it sets a really bad precedent.
Yeah. But that's the problem. That's what people think. People think that being a critical thinker means being an asshole. And if you broaden back to the reason we talk about philosophy so much on a critical thinking podcast is because there's a lot of overlap. Ultimately, what critical thinking is intended to do is allow you to make good choices on both a practical and moral axis. By axis, I just mean a chart. I don't mean Nazis. Jesus Christ, people.
I know.
but there's the thing, right? The fact that we have to say this shows how much dogmatic heuristic we deal with on a daily basis in our lives right now. And I find it quite, I'm going to take a big swing right now and come out and say that I think that this lazy thinking, the unwillingness to stop and smell the logic sometimes, just stop and think about what you're doing and do a few thought exercises and see if you're not on the fast train to crazy town. People are afraid of doing that because they're afraid if they defy that consensus, they defy that groupthink, they're going to get excommunicated for heresy. The middle ground where some challenge is permitted without tearing the whole system down has evaporated. I believe the reason I wanted to do this podcast is I believe it's because people have been confusing deductive reasoning for inductive reasoning since and perhaps before the popularization of Sherlock Holmes.
Yes, and also there is another element that has become more intense over the recent years. Mm-hmm. And it is, of course, the identification problem, where people become so identified emotionally with their positions and with their beliefs that going through the process of testing and verification is essentially, in their minds, tantamount to assaulting themselves.
Yeah, and I've been struggling lately based on the craziness that happened online, but even before this, whether that's innate, whether some people have a looser sense of innate immutable identity than others, or whether you can teach someone to go beyond, I am this, I am this, I am this, put together, that's who I am. That the idea of individual self-actualization is perhaps not possible for every person. I'm not sure about that.
Well, I think that it is possible, generally speaking.
Right.
You have some people who have a harder time than others. Speaking as someone who knows someone, for example, who suffers from borderline personality disorder, you have cases in which people's sense of identity is a lot, is compromised in many ways because of, you know, situations. In this case, for example, lack of emotional permanence, mm-hmm. Which is the signature issue in borderline personality disorder.
For people who don't understand the concept of emotional permanence, what does that mean?
Okay, so how will I break it down? Give me one second.
Yeah, I think this is actually at the core of what I didn't realize this when we started it, but the idea of object permanence, emotional permanence, all that stuff, it's a core concept here that I think people need to understand.
That is true. Give me one second. I almost closed your chat.
Oh, no.
Go away. Windows 10.
Talk about a lack of object permanence. Curse you, Windows 10.
So You could say it is not terribly unrelated to object permanence. Mm-hmm. It is just on the emotional spectrum. Someone, you know, someone who is neurotypical would be able to mentally process an emotion without assigning an expiration date to it, for mm-hmm. example. But someone who doesn't have emotional permanence, they won't be able to do so after a certain amount of time, and they will start to falsify whatever has happened. So you can say to someone, you know, I think you're great. I think your projects are really good. The right. quality of work you're putting out is very, very, you know, is very high quality. Mm-hmm. For you, you know, if you're neurotypical, then that is something that you keep for a while.
You remember that the next time you're criticized and go, no, this person isn't right with their sweeping generalization that my ideas are no good.
Right.
Right.
But if you don't have emotional permanence, you can basically, ask, it's kind of out of mind, out of sight after a while.
Yeah.
That validation has disappeared, and it becomes this kind of pull me, pull you behavior where the person tries to get more validation because due to the fact of a lack of emotional permanence, it's not there. They don't, what you said to them like a week ago may not feel as real to them. Now, of course, emotional permanence is something that you can build, and people who have to deal with borderline personality disorder diagnosis, mm-hmm. There are ways to build that, and there are ways to help people with that personality disorder, in a way, kind of become their own witnesses to the thoughts that are coming through. Of course, like in everything, sometimes they will succeed, mm-hmm. sometimes they will fail because of the intensity of the emotion attached, which it's a microcosm of what happens to everyone, because even though you might not have emotional impermanence, but some days you're feeling more vulnerable than others.
Right.
And so, you know, so it's not a thing that only happens to people who have this diagnosed personality disorder.
Yeah, that's where I was sort of going with this, is there's some theories that in our, you know, so-called participation ribbon culture, that the participation ribbon culture, especially in education, has eroded emotional permanence on a societal level. And that's part of the reason we're having so many problems with disagreement on big issues.
Right, because disagreement is seen in many ways as an invalidation.
Yes, yeah. And that's a lack of emotional permanence.
And yeah, you're right in many ways, because we as a society recently, we have not prepared our children to have a kind of resilience, emotional resilience, to be able to deal with these things in a calm, collected, and logical manner. We have not taught our children to find that center of intellectual and emotional tranquility. This is something I see in a lot of minority activist groups. As a minority myself, I've seen this in a lot of the gay subculture activist groups. There is a problem in separating injustice and bad behavior from other people and the impact such things have on your self-esteem. The problem that I am seeing is that a lot of people disturbingly derive their self-esteem from the acceptance of others.
Well, that's what they've been taught to do in a ride share, room share, work share. Everything is a star rating. Your value comes from a star rating assigned by others.
Exactly. And that is a problem. That is a problem because if your self-esteem is in the power of others, if it is constantly in the power of others, then you're essentially handing people the power to define you.
That's right.
If That's right. you cannot, and I understand, for example, I know that for a lot of trans individuals, being misgendered is, you know, in many, many cases, it is an attempt at insult.
Well, it's from let's be fair. If there's dysphoria at play, it's like, you know, that the worst sensitivity you have, mm-hmm. if somebody just gets anywhere near that, you can't help it. You kind of lose it.
Yeah.
I get that. I understand that's something I think we can all relate to when it's explained mm-hmm. in that way. We can have compassion. We can understand, you know, based on the golden rule, we don't want people picking at those scabs on us. So don't do it to other people.
Right. The problem is that we deal with people who don't believe that, they firmly believe in their high school science class definition of sex and gender, which we calmly took apart a couple of podcasts ago.
Right, right.
And who are looking at trans individuals as, well, first of all, they feel threatened by them they exist outside of these guys' and women's high school's definition of what gender is.
Hold that thought, because I'll apply the chart to it, right?
Okay.
This is an example of instead of having a standard of biological sex and social gender and the intersection between the two things, we have heuristics of biological sex and social gender. Meaning instead mm-hmm. of saying that biological sex is a combination of both anatomy and physiology, and in some cases those don't match, giving us the category of intersex individual, there is a heuristic, a short form, PP means boy, you know, vajayjay means girl.
Yeah.
There's a shining example of the difference between standardized deductive analysis and standardized inductive
reasoning. Inductive analysis.
Yeah, 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 yeah. So go on. So
we have these people who are deeply offended by something that exists outside of these heuristics.
Because they engage in dogma. Their thinking is dogma. So they need Gina Carano to put her pronouns in her Twitter profile because that validates them. And I thought that whole thing was absurd.
Yeah.
Did you follow that?
I only vaguely heard about it. So you might want to fill the listeners.
Basically happened is on a keyboard warrior activism is going after Gina Carano, better known as Cara Dune, in The Mandalorian, and that awesome chick from Deadpool. People were pushing her online to put her in her Twitter bio. And she was like, what? Why? You know, instead of explaining to her, giving her the deductive steps as to why it was important, they made these abductive leaps, which is, if you don't do it, you're transphobic. They went right to dogma. And so Gina Carano, apparently being a pretty logical thinking person with some pretty strong personal boundaries, went, I'm not going to do something just because people are yelling at me. And so she did something cheeky. She put pronouns beep, bop, boop in her Twitter bio, mm-hmm. thinking that was cute because it's basically the way R2-D2 talks. She's in Star Wars, right? Freak out. She was labeled transphobic. The issue from both a deductive and inductive point, and this is why I see the point that abductive leaps are a different category than induction, is if you do that white swan, white swan, white swan thinking, mm-hmm. you know, that misses the black swan. If you look at the bios of these very people, the type that are screaming at Gina Carano, they have things like pronouns, Nyan cat, you know, that little digital cat with the rainbows coming out of their butt.
No, I remember that.
Yeah. It's one of these things that within subcultures, within marginalized communities, people try to reclaim terms that are hurtful. And it doesn't always work. And you get partial adoption. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the very fact that they're upset when someone else does it indicates that the reclamation of the whole practice is incomplete. And perhaps from a deductive standpoint, you shouldn't be doing that. Oh God, heresy, right? Mm-hmm. Heresy to suggest that perhaps someone should think about consistency as opposed to just self-soothing, right? But that's the problem is I remember looking at some of these things. It's like they're doing all the things they get mad at other people for doing, but because they are so soaked in dogma, which is making a whole bunch of leaps of logic that other people can't follow, even though it makes complete sense to the person doing it. Hence, you get a lot of people standing on the sidelines very, very confused, because to them, it looks instead of white swan, white swan, white swan, all swans are white, which is an understandable mistake, even though it's wrong. Mm-hmm. What people from the sidelines are going is they're trying to tell me a swan is a duck, right? Because right. They're both birds. And because that piece of deductive or inductive step is missing, people start going, buzzer, what? I cannot follow you. And that's pretty much what Gina Carano did. And people just kept screaming at her. And clearly Disney's okay with it, because I'm pretty sure if Disney wasn't okay with it, she'd have done stuff to keep her job, you mm-hmm. know? But I really think it's strange, as an aside, and then we'll get back on your point, that some of the biggest critical thinkers in terms of morality that have come out of pop culture in recent history have been either wrestlers, MMA fighters turned actors. So like Gina Carano, Dave Bautista, people who are like, no, I know this person. I know they are a good person. They may have made some mistakes in terms of political correctness, but they do not have hate in their hearts. I'm not going to jump on the mobbing, you know, the pitchforks in the streets, because it's trendy. I find that very interesting that the great academics of our times, the great thinkers, are falling prey to this mythologized dogma. And people who would be easily dismissed as meatheads have got it going on. Now, I don't know if just because their dogma is accidentally more accurate than the other dogma. It's like, it's an observation I am not willing to take an induction based on this. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I'm not willing to assign it a greater meaning yet. And I don't know about you, Mouse, that's where I get into trouble. The unwillingness to make the greater hypothesis in a given situation, because I don't have enough data yet.
Well, if you look at the emotional mechanisms that kind of drive these mobs, it really does go back to that emotional impermanence. I'm pretty convinced yeah. that it's, and for that, there's a very good book by Nassim Nicholas Taleb called Anti-Fragile, Things That Gain From Disorder. Because I think it talks about building emotional resilience. And wow, I can't.
Dense. No wonder you're having trouble putting it into words.
It is pretty dense. It's something that you should, that it should be read.
Well, there you go. Because
it really...
The same author has a book called The Black Swan, based on that white swan inductive mistake.
Mm-hmm. It all comes around. They're rather beautifully synchronistic.
What the book is arguing, essentially, Anti-Fragile, is that sometimes people and things benefit from shocks to the system.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's the anti-fragility as something different than resilience or robustness. The resilient resists shocks and change stays the same. An anti-fragile entity uses the shock to improve.
Right. It's the growth mentality versus the conservative mentality.
Yeah.
And the problem is, I know that a lot of the keyboard warrior activists would not agree with this depiction, but we have to remember that I am not speaking in political terms. I'm speaking of terms of dynamics, of intellectual, emotional dynamics.
Right.
A lot of these people are conservatives.
Who are anti-fragile or who are resilient?
Well, they are conservatives in that they do not accept for a moment the notion that they might be wrong.
Oh, gotcha. So it's more that do we call them conservative or do we call them authoritarian?
Here's the thing. Mm-hmm. Something I have come to realize is that, and again, I am not speaking on a political bent. I'm speaking on an intellectual bent. Conservatism always eventually leads to authoritarianism,
mm-hmm.
because intellectual conservatism is the worshiping of the intellectual status quo.
It's dogma.
It is dogma.
Yeah.
And so it can arise in politically liberal parties. It can arise everywhere, regardless of any political bent, because I'm speaking of the intellectual root, the intellectual motivation. It is the people who are resistant to the heliocentric proposal of our solar system, because they were absolutely convinced that it was a geocentric model, because of course we are the center of the universe.
Right. They don't question their thinking. Mm-hmm. A more modern example, so that people who lean conservative who are listening to this, yes, there's a lot of conservative dogma, but also the example of the alleged followers of anti-racism pioneer Ibram X. Kendi, who take his alleged structure, but ignore the large portions of the book where he actually talks about his own anti-white racism and how he came up with these procedures to try to indicate that, no, anybody can be racist, which is why you have to be actively anti-racist. He was arguing critical thought. He was arguing deductive reasoning, and people abducted. It's fascinating, the phenomenon around that book.
It is. It's the dropping of the context. They took the form, but shaved away the substance, because the substance takes a while to digest and internalize, whereas you can simply ape the form of things.
Well, and again, if you're really following that model, you do end up again in that borderline between heresy and standard, when most people are much more comfortable with dogma and heuristics.
Mm-hmm.
They'd rather just be able to feel something, never have to examine that feeling, that emotional impermanence you're talking about. Just burn through everything on an emotional level and be allowed to do that. Because I think, challenge me on this, please. That is what they believe authenticity to be. And it's not. A truly authentic person knows when to question their own reactions.
So in a way, they're kind of stuck in a in a hedonistic feedback loop. No, I don't mean exactly by pleasure.
Yeah,
I
exactly.
Don't mean exactly by pleasure, as most people consider hedonism, but in kind of the reveling of this emotion.
Well, it's anti-hedonism. It's just constantly seeking out misery.
That's true. Well, you could argue that being miserable is what makes you is what you think makes you happy. You are in a hedonistic pursuit.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of Schopenhauer gone really wrong, right? Well, no, I know that's kind of a cheeky heuristic in and of itself, but yeah, it's this, and unfortunately the term anti-hedonism is already taken, but it's this funhouse mirror hedonism, which instead of seeking out pleasure and avoiding suffering, they're seeking out suffering and avoiding pleasure.
Let's use a term. Okay, so the Dresden Kodak is a really fun web comic.
Yeah,
that deals with, you know, things like transhumanism, etc. The author created this game called Discourse in Dungeons that plays with philosophy. You're not a bard like Dungeons and Dragons. You're not like a bard or a warrior. You're a philosopher. You could be a Stoic. You could be an objectivist. You could be a Marxist, a Kantian. It's a lot of fun because it pokes fun at every single school of philosophy. So the source book is free to get, so you can get it. The third edition is out, but in one of the variants, you can be a dark Kantian. In which you're
like a fallen paladin.
Yes, your moral imperative is to do evil. So we can create a category for people who fall under this. We can call them a dark hedonist.
Dark Schopenhauer just sounds like a sex dark position. it just does. Like. But it is though, right?
I just have terrible mental image. Change alone is eternal, perpetual, yeah. Immortal. Oh yes.
Yeah, exactly. It's I mean, Schopenhauer is considered the artist philosopher for a reason. However, as much as we're joking, it does sort of put the period on the sentence, doesn't it? That this is the behavior, this is the observed behavior, that they are seeking out misery, because they're cruising the internet looking for something to get triggered by so they can scream. And the question is, what does that provide a person? And okay, you give your theory first, I'll give mine afterwards.
Well, a lot of this type of activism has kind of like a moral imperative at the very bottom, that you need to be doing, that you need to be speaking, you need to be constantly defending and working. And so something I have observed, a lot is that a lot of these people that I have run into feel like they have a duty to put themselves out in the line of fire, so to speak, and have that confrontation, have that visceral clashing of horns, because otherwise they feel guilty that they're not doing enough. And of course, this is the problem with duty, with deontology, with duty-bound ethics, because, and I don't subscribe to those. I don't subscribe to deontology, but we know that a lot of modern activism is subsumed in many ways with certain Marxist idealism. And a lot of Marxist idealism is deontological. It's duty bound to a group, to a collective. So you have this sense that you need to save the world. You need to do this. You need to do that. Now, you can, I think there is a difference between, you know, believing this is right and this is wrong. Because I want to live in this world and because I want to have a productive life, I should, you know, do what I can to fight this injustice. And this goes, you know, and my desire to defend others is rooted in that, because what is the rights that I want to have recognized that are my actual rights mm-hmm. don't extend solely to me. Mm-hmm. By nature, they extend to other people.
Right.
It's in that pairing of my self-interest with the interest of others, because if you can't do that, you have to ask yourself, is this really in my actual self-interest, or am I just having a whim and I'm trying to justify it with fancy wording?
You went inductive in this and your conclusions were far more charitable than my deductive ones are. And that's very interesting, because you leave open the fact of this is just my thought, I could be wrong, right? Which is mm-hmm. is the right role for induction, but you're giving benefit of doubt, which is laudable. I'm at the point where I don't anymore. I'm at the point where I do think that there are certain base codes in certain people. Now, people, you can change your coding. That's the whole purpose of dialectic behavioral therapy, the stories you tell yourself about your own story. But the idea of progression, the idea of, you know, whether people can change is based on, at its core, a series of deductive statements. And what deductive statement you choose as your mantra sets how you approach big problems, right? Mm-hmm. One person can look at change is hard, factual statement, right? It's often very hard to change. Doing hard things takes a lot of work and energy. Therefore, a person with logic, change requires a lot of hard work and energy. They go in to change, prepared to put in the work, because they recognize that morality and becoming a better person and doing the right thing is not easy. Someone else may look at the problem of worthwhile things are hard. Change is hard. Therefore, change is worthwhile. Another positive spin on change. However, I think these keyboard warriors, and I've talked to many of them, mostly on the more libertarian, conservative, dipping their toe in nihilism side, more than that than the left, but I've talked to a few left-wing people, and this was consistent. The dialectic, the deductive dialectic that they give themselves is, change is hard. I can't do hard things. Therefore, I can't change. And when you come at social issues, which are complex and messy and quite difficult, changes, so widespread macro social change is hard because you have to come at it indirectly through battles of inches, right? And so when they come at these things mm-hmm. going, I can't change, it's too hard. They start getting into that spiral of good people change. So if good people mean change and I can't change, then I'm a bad person. And that's where they go, Ree! And they get that feedback loop we're seeing on the internet. So they're mm-hmm. going out of their way to get the white swan, white swan, white swan game, right? The duck, duck, goose of white swans. They're lining up their white swans by chasing transgression on the internet. And when they hit a black swan, when they hit a person that is coming at something from an undeniably moral standpoint, i.e., I will not change just because you're screaming at me, give me a logical argument, their whole theory falls apart and they just lose it, because that's the black swan. The induction that they've lived by has now been rattled. That means change. They think they can't change because change is too hard. Crash, right? Emotional impermanence, meltdown.
That's what I experienced last weekend. Yeah. When I said, okay, basically the argument boiled down to, you know, this is this because I say so, because I am part of, you know, my identity is such and such.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, you're asking me to take something on faith.
Yep. Yeah. I saw you say that.
Because this is, I grew up Catholic. And I could go into a whole musical number from nonsense about that, but
yeah.
I grew up Catholic, and the constant thing that until I got to the Jesuits, the Jesuits were different.
Yeah.
But the constant argument was, this is so because we say so.
Yes.
And you have to believe it. You cannot question
it. Yeah, don't question it.
Of course, the Jesuits were different, which is why the Jesuits for the longest time
were heretics.
Until one of them got elected Pope. I have no idea how that happened.
Now he's causing all kinds of shit.
But you know, the Jesuits were always kind of on the outside of things in the Catholic Church. I mean, they ran the observatory. They're usually the more well-read, better educated of religious orders, and like say the Franciscans or the Dominicans. And so when I got to them, it was okay. I said to my theology teacher, I said, who is actually, this is hilarious. My theology teacher was best friends with the Pope, the current Pope. When Francisco became the Pope, the only person he visited in Ecuador was my theology teacher.
Interesting.
It was hilarious.
You got a hookup.
I got a hookup. Unfortunately, he passed away last year.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
He lived a long life drinking wine and cigars. He was.
Theology though, death is not the end. So you still got a hookup. You got a direct hookup now. You got a hookup to upstairs. You in the C-suite, man.
That's true.
I've been binge watching Lucifer. It's delightful in its revelry and in deductive heresy. Excellent, excellent show in that regard. But go on, yeah.
And so, when I said to my theology teacher, you know, I'm an atheist. Mm-hmm. I do not believe. And he said, okay. And he said, but that still doesn't excuse you from attending my class, because he taught theology.
Right.
I said, if you're going to be an atheist, you might as well know why and be able to tell me why. And he was also my philosophy teacher.
Yeah.
And he said, as I've already taught you, before you can refute an argument, you need to know it to its fullest.
Precisely.
So, you're not skipping my class. And I went, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, until I got to the Jesuits, the majority of the arguments put forth by Christians to me was, especially by Christian priests, one of them who said, I read too much and that was my problem.
Oh, geez.
And red flag right there.
Yeah, of course.
Funny enough, he said the same thing to my dad and my mom, but so, you know, it's a family sin.
Right.
The argument was, this is the truth. This is what you must believe. You must accept this. And you cannot argue with this. You cannot question this, because it is a sin to question this.
Mm-hmm.
And I encountered that very same type of argument. They made the claim, this is this. And because we are this group, we get to define that. We get to say that, and you don't get to ask why.
Right.
And I said to them, I said, that's not how it works. If you want me to understand, you have to explain it to me, because what you want is understanding. You don't want faith,
right?
Because faith does not create understanding. Faith is essentially what you believe out of fear of authority.
Yeah, faith is obedience, not understanding.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the claim was that I was speaking over them. And I said, no, speaking over someone is, for example, when you speak over a child who's throwing a tantrum. You speak over a child who's having a tantrum because a child is not capable of reason, at least of complete reason. So you do not expect the child to be able to put forth a rational argument.
And that is precisely where the idea that, you know, in a patriarchal system, men speak over women, for just as an example, or white people speak over Black people because they are treating them like children.
Exactly.
Right.
And so I said to them, I am not speaking over you. I am treating you like an adult. I am asking you for a reason, a reasoned argument that is beyond, that is not because I said so, because I am treating you exactly the opposite of a child, but you're treating that as an offense against you.
And you know what I've taken away from the freaking out over the whole like Gina Carano issue and the J.K. Rowling issue and all the stuff. My takeaway sorting through this stuff is there are valid points at the core of some of these reactions. They're just not making it.
Right. There's valid points. They're just being atrociously handled.
Yeah. And the problem is that in many, we both know that for some marginalized people, the internet is the only place that they can actually find people who will validate them. They spend most of their lives being invalidated. The internet's an escape from that. However, the internet is also the place where you are most likely to be deeply challenged in your beliefs. If you have a firmly held belief, that's fine. A firmly held belief can resist a challenge. It's that anti-fragility thing. It grows stronger through being challenged. But if someone has body dysmorphia, for instance, you could argue it is both dysmorphic in that it was formed wrong and dysphoric. One might argue that dysmorphic might be the more affirming term. But, you know, when you are dysphoric, when you have that, not even just a lack of emotional permanence, a lack of body permanence, right? What's going on the inside, what's going on the outside, don't match. I get why people are not able to logic through the reactions they are having to certain things. It's just, it hurts. Get it away, which is why those people need help and they need support, right? The people that are going through that stuff. I have a real issue with people who use activism as therapy for precisely that reason. Because activism has to be organized and has to be on message. Therapy is by its very nature messy.
Yes, and it will be very messy.
Yeah, and this idea, I mean, this whole thing of, you know, if you don't agree with us, you're racist, or if you don't agree with us, you're homophobic, or if you don't agree with us, you're transphobic. Those are people rooted in dogma and stereotype accusing the deductive reasoner, the person going, give me a reason, give me facts I can apply, you're basically being accused of heresy. And that never works long-term.
Right. And of course, we got to remember that, of course, it goes without saying, but sometimes you have to say it. Not every single person challenging you on the internet has worthwhile points. That most, a lot of the times, they are just assholes.
Especially if they bring 100 of their closest friends with them. Now,
yes,
I'll close this off with a bit of hope, though. Mouse will still get the last word. Don't worry, guys. I saw this exact same burn the heretic thinking in the 90s with gay rights, the beginning of the marriage equality fight. I saw the exact same behavior, and it was just as nasty, and it was just as vicious, and they seemed just as powerful back then. But they are only power in fringe microcosms. They don't actually have a lot of sway over, you know, that larger, over those so-called, you know, orthodox constructs, meaning moderate society, right? The Overton window we talked about. In the 90s, there was a very vocal group that came out of basically the queer culture cinema traditions of the 1970s that believed that the fight that advocating for marriage equality was homophobic. People are like, what? This is the logic. And it's very similar to some of the stuff now, that because because marriage is a heteronormative construct, because marriage is between a man and a woman, pushing for gay marriage is forcing gay people to conform to heteronormative constructs. Of course, the error in thinking in that whole thing is that the idea of marriage is in fact defined by man and woman instead of just two consenting adults. That's how these things work. It is that simple as just starting from a statement of truth that is not in fact truth, right? That's what you've got to be really, uh-huh. really careful of. It's like transposing a 7 and a 4. A 7, a 2, and a 4. When I was taking very advanced math courses, that seems so strange now, but I guess I still kind of familiar things. But I noticed that mathematicians put a score in a 7 instead of the regular way we do it, which is just like, you know, a horizontal line, diagonal line, right? Mm-hmm. And at one point I asked why they did that. And my math teacher, who's, oh my God, incredible teacher. He loved Pythagoras, which really made sense because I didn't realize at the time how much he dropped philosophy into mathematics classes. His name was Jeff Schifrin, brilliant, brilliant guy. But he explained that when you're doing mathematics, a 7 can look like a 2 if you accidentally drag your pencil along the paper. So you put a score in the middle of the 7 to make sure that didn't happen. Well, didn't I start putting a score in the middle of a 7 all the time after that? Because
I do that all the time because my handwriting is absolutely, you've seen my handwriting, it is absolutely atrocious and my numbers are even worse.
Well, it's so funny because I tend to drop N's in my handwriting, which is funny because I have a name with an N in it. So
you're Leah.
I'm Leah, which that is a sound I often make. Yeah. I sound like the Cowardly Lion from The Wizard of Oz. But it's one of those meditation points of, interesting. But this is the stuff that happens when you get a firm sense of self. There's too many people out there who, through no fault of their own, not only do not have a solid sense of self, but they are constantly actively encouraged to not have one. Because if you don't have a solid sense of self, you're more easy to control. And
that is true.
There's a lot of money in creating masses of controllable, predictable people. Because keep in mind, marketers and social theorists, they know that individuals are difficult to predict. Groups of people are much easier to predict.
Hello, Harry Seldon.
Yeah, there you go. And so because political pollsters and, you know, business people and advertisers, they want surety. They want to know which buttons to hit to get a return on their investment. There's meaningful cultural forces discouraging deduction, discouraging individuality. Because when you start deducing, when you start thinking through deduction, you do individualize.
Right. And one thing I wanted to bring up that I forgot, but I just remembered, is that induction and deduction can work and often work better hand in hand.
Well, that's what Sherlock Holmes says, yeah.
Right. If you start the process of forming your theory through an inductive process, and then you test it through a deductive process, you have an integrated intellectual machinery right there.
Well, that's exactly what you do in mathematics when you're doing algebra. Mm-hmm. Is you solve for X, right? Which is solving for a variable based on what's around it. You deduce whether your action is correct by taking the value you got for X, plunking it in your original equation, and seeing if it works.
Mm-hmm.
That's the loop. That's what you're supposed to do as a critical thinker. And as much as, you know, people like to blame Sherlock Holmes for muddying the two terms, people are responsible for figuring out what these terms mean and using language with reason. And that's part of the reason why Lewis Carroll, who was a mathematician in his day job, and his algebraic poetry that people refer to as nonsense poetry was so apt. Because what Carroll was doing was creating words that you could infer their meaning by their context, right? 'Twas mm-hmm. brillig in the slithy toves, the guiling gimber in the grape, right? None yep. of that is real words, but we kind of, 'twas brillig, okay, that sounds like burr, it sounds kind of cold, right? Yep. And the slithy tove, we get a sense of something's either slimy or slithery or something like that. That is like the height of poetry to me, because the meaning, he's almost overleaping metaphor and going straight into syntax construction.
Yes.
Which, when you start, you know, there's a lot of talk in extremely blue-pilled circles about taking the red pill, but seeing the matrix is essentially that. Unfortunately, what a lot of people who talk about the red pill and the blue pill miss about that whole analogy is that the blue pill is actually comfortable, right? Like, that's mm-hmm. the safer choice. That's the one that most people, when it's not stated so simply, that's the choice most people make, right? They just keep yep. doing the same things they've always done. They don't want to know. Not in real terms. People don't really want to know inconvenient truths. What we've got to do as moral thinkers, and I do think this is possible based on what I saw with the gay rights movement, starting from places of utter insanity, like, like marriage equality is homophobic, right? We're just seeing that repeat again in with trans activism. There were similar things within the civil rights movement, right? You know, the thin line, there was the Black Power movement, but then there was basically the Black Supremacy movement, where the mm-hmm. only way to truly emancipate the Black man was to make the Black man have power over the white man, because the white man's never going to give equality, right? That was the argument. There was the idea that Black people should just go back to Africa, where they can be, you know, rulers of their own destiny, said by people who had never been to Africa. You know, to be clear, these are not white people saying this. These were Black people with some influence, saying mm-hmm. that melting pot, that mosaic multiculturalism, that pluralism was not possible. The only way to be in control of their destiny was to segregate, take an entire continent and just claim it as theirs. Boom, there we go. Obviously, nobody talks about that anymore, right? Like, go right. back to Africa is considered a racial slur.
Uh-huh.
This stuff happens. And so I really do believe that if everybody just takes a breath and keeps checking their own assumptions through deduction and just being, you know, inducing that these people who are horrendous, mean, awful, cruel bullies are also in a great amount of pain. Uh-huh. And the goal is to look for the black swans within all those white swans, because those are the ones you can extract, right? Those are the ones you can, that's what the Jesuits did with you, right?
Yes.
Instead of forcing you to be a white swan, they accepted you as a black swan. And probably yep. the only reason you have any respect for formal morality structures is because of that experience, I suspect. You know, because otherwise you just would have been F this all. You have some respect for religious structures, even if you don't believe in them.
I was very much into an F this all mood before I got into that school.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah. Well, for obvious reasons, you were rejected everywhere, right?
Right. I was the even though I didn't come out, everybody kind of pretty much imagined, sort of knew without telling that I was gay, and so of course I was constantly hammered with the whole Catholic attitude of homosexuality in you know, the 90s and early 2000s.
Well, and I think that Francis, and we'll leave this here, I think that Francis, being a Jesuit, understands the deductive error that most people, you know, that you have regarding Catholicism, of mm-hmm. recognizing that they know and love gay people in their lives that are moral people. And they recognize the logical failing of being gay automatically makes you bad somehow. It's a sin, right? This does not compute. And I think this Pope Francis, being a Jesuit, recognizes he's losing people. They're losing people from the Catholic faith just because any thinking person recognizes mm-hmm. now that, you know, this isn't true. The problem is that he's fighting dogma, and he has to argue consensus, right? So he has to argue truth. He has mm-hmm. to argue standards. He can't take the purely logical leap that I think he'd like to and just commit complete acts of heresy and go, nope, everybody before me was wrong. Being gay is fine. Let's start doing gay marriages. He recognizes he can't do that.
Yeah.
Right? And that's the difference between rhetoric and reason. And maybe we should discuss that next week.
We should.
The intersection of rhetoric and reason. Or rhyme and reason. Rhyme and reason.
Rhyme and reason.
Phantom toll booth. Invoke the phantom toll booth.
Here with and there with. Let everyone take note now. Yes, okay. I still remember the songs.
Not only is Mouse singing, but we have come to the second podcast in a row where we did not mention Ayn Rand.
Nope.
The streak has been broken. I don't know what to do. I'm sure rhetoric, I'm sure Ayn Rand will come up in rhetoric and reason.
I'm pretty sure.
I don't know. But I just want to mark the occasion. This is two straight podcasts with no reference to Ayn Rand. Did referencing no reference mean I referenced her?
That's like the fault. That is like the falsehood, the lying Greek argument.
Yeah, I think I referenced a non-reference, which is not, in essence,
a direct reference.
A reference. Yeah. I need to go watch Bedknobs and Broomsticks like right now. Okay, this has been the Broken Clock podcast that may have broken your brain this episode. I don't know. The response to this is going to be interesting. FUnetwork.tv. If you like what you've heard, kick us a few bucks on PayPal, or even better, become a monthly patron. You can do that all through the website. Mouse, as usual, you have the final word.
And this is a quote from Epictetus, not Epictetus, Epictetus.
That's Bedknobs. Okay.
That's Dolly Parton.
God. Okay. Yeah.
So the quote is, as you think, so you become. Avoid investing events with power or meanings they don't have. Keep your head. Our busy minds are forever jumping to conclusions, manufacturing and interpreting signs that aren't there. Assume instead that everything that happens to you does so for some good, that if you decided to be lucky, you are lucky. All events contain an advantage for you if you look for it.